This is just for, okay. So today is parashah number 9, and it has to do with Genesis 37 to 40, verse 23, which is just the end of chapter 40. So again, there's a lot going on in the parashah, and it's kind of a cool one for most of us, because most of us grew up listening to the stories. This is obviously about Joseph from beginning to end, and then it stops at a certain point. We'll have two more parashahs about Joseph's life. So this is really familiar to everybody, you know, who Joseph was, what happened, the animosity his brothers had for him. And we learned from the previous parashah that Jacob kind of set this up the way he set the caravan up with Bilhah and Zilpah's children first, and then Leah, and then so Joseph last. So there was no doubt in anyone's mind who Jacob's favorite child was. And then also in Jacob's mind, because Rachel was the one that he chose rather than Leah originally, he believed Rachel's firstborn would be the progenitor of the covenant. So something we don't necessarily think about. Jacob's mind, Rachel was the choice, and so her firstborn would be the favored one, would carry on like he did. So we know from history and able to look backwards that God had something else in mind. The fact that Leah was the first meant that one of her sons would be in the line of Messiah. Some interesting points to take from it. There's a lot of things that went on in the narrative and things that I kind of, you take for granted, really. At one point, after Joseph gives a bad report about his brothers, and then he has some dreams, and being the foolish young, a teenager he was anxious to share the dreams, and we don't know, the Bible doesn't necessarily give us his motive for doing so. It doesn't say that it was bad or good, so we're left to that as youthful indiscretion. But the fact that him doing that, coupled with history, family history, if you read there, his brothers hated him more and more every time he told the story. So it wasn't something that was going away. It was going to come to a head. And so, Jacob gives him this really cool coat. And, you know, by all accounts, you look to the rabbis and some of what they say, it's very, very expensive, extravagant gift, only one that royalty would wear. So quite a bit was spent on it. And so I guess what I would see is that the father was not hiding the fact that Joseph was first in line. And, human nature, in one way, you can't hardly blame his brothers for having jealousy, because this was extravagant, what he was doing. And the fact that he took the report from Joseph over against his brothers, didn't matter what his brothers said, that Joseph's report was believed. So the younger was set over all the older ones. And so it created a family dynamic that, you know, that played out in really difficult, I mean, it was quite horrific what actually ended up happening, brothers betraying a brother and all the things that happened. But for me, when you take a step back and you look, now you look at things, and if we continue to keep that thread of Genesis 3 in our minds, we're always going to look at the seed. So whatever we're doing in Torah, wherever we're reading, we should keep that thread in our mind. We're looking at the seed. What does this have to do with the seed? And all the interaction here, what does it have to do with the seed? So we come in from a place where we already read the story. We read through the New Covenant Scriptures, the Apostolic Scriptures. We know what happened, what went on. But what we don't see is that there are a lot of things at play here that were, some of it was left to human reality. For instance, there's a debate in the rabbi community as far as who was that man at Shechem that told Joseph that his brothers went on. Think for a moment, what would have happened if Joseph fulfilled what his dad said? He went to Shechem, his brothers went there, so he went back. He's not sold in slavery, he's not taken by his brothers and given to the Ishmaelites. So what happens? The whole story changes. Something else would have to take place. But God in sovereignty, so the point with the rabbis is Rashi, the medieval sage, believed that that was Gabriel, one of the archangels, he believed that Gabriel took the man, the shape of man, and said, "Hey, your brothers are there." So therefore, keeping the narrative moving in God and what God's design was, because otherwise Joseph may have turned around. If that man's not there, he'd turn around and went back. Said, "Hey, Dad, they took off your sheep and goats. I don't know where they went." So that interaction, they're saying, "Hey, that's God's providence in making what God's doing continue that line and the progression." So we don't know. It doesn't tell us if it was simply a man or it was an angel. But the fact is that in biblical language, the word for messenger and word for angel are one and the same. So we can draw a conclusion that, and it doesn't necessarily mean one means more than the other. The fact that the story went on because of someone's interaction, and a man that was out in the middle of nowhere, it seems improbable, but he was just hanging out waiting for a bus, so or a camel to come by. So however he's going to get to where he was going. So to me, that was kind of a cool subplot that, you know, God is watching over everything that's going on. He had a plan from the beginning, and he's going to get it to the end. And the fact that he's using various people to do so, and they come and go and interject what they need to interject is what's important. And later on, we're going to see how important that is. I'm going to have Mom and Sandy share about their adventures in giving out the gifts. And so we'll see firsthand that who they visited, why they visited them, who they didn't visit, why they didn't visit them, where their travels took them. The cool part for us is we've been interceding before and during that whole time. So our part was to play the part of intercessors. And from what I see, that's every bit as important, if not so, than the people who are actually on the ground. Because without that, there could be danger, there could be all sorts of things waiting that Satan had planned set to thwart what they were doing. So intercession and prayer covering is a very, very important part of giving. And also having them have the ability to hear what the Spirit's saying. Rook's going, "All right, turn left, turn right, stop, don't go there, and go here." So if everybody read through the parasha, you can see how that took place. There were many things that happened here that required God's providence, whether it be man interjecting, using the hatred of the brothers towards Joseph. Because the big picture is here is what? If Joseph doesn't go to Egypt, what happens to Jacob's entire clan?
They all starve.
They starve to death. Or God would have to intervene another way. But the fact that this is the way he chose to do it, and this is what happened. And keep in mind that pre-incarnate Yeshua already prophesied that this was going to happen. He told Abraham, he told Abraham, "Your people are going to go into slavery for 400 years in this land. This is what happened, and this is the outcry from that. This is what happened from Israel going into Egypt for 400 years. So it was already prophesied that it was going to happen. So I guess that's another part that I wanted to talk about, is that each step along the way, it was God did this. I mean, I was looking at the various things that happened in the story, and I'm thinking, you know, how would we possibly know that? Because we have hindsight again. We know that Judah became the line of Messiah. And we only know that looking backwards because we have the information. At this point, that was not the case. Because he was going through from Reuben to Levi to Simeon to Judah. And in Jacob's mind, it was Joseph. Joseph was the one in Jacob's mind. So things had to change. Another thing to throw in, who was Israel's first king?
Saul.
No, it was Saul. So Shaul was the first king. Well, what tribe was he from? Benjamin. So didn't that sound ironic? To me, that's an irony, because this narrative is interrupted by what? Did anybody catch the interruption? The story of Joseph is interrupted in chapter what? 38. It's the story of Judah, Tamar, and Judah's sons. So why would he put that in there? Seemingly there was no connection to anything that was going on. You could draw some outlying conclusions, like it showed Judah's unfaithfulness in as far as promiscuity, sleeping with a prostitute, which was his daughter-in-law, and the fact that Joseph, given the opportunity to sleep with a very powerful man's wife, he set that aside. He said that's very, very evil in God's eyes. So, I mean, that you could say that that's a story that parallels, but I don't see that that would create the reason for Judah's story to be put in there. So a lot of the people, the commentaries I read, believe that God already knew that Judah would be the ultimate one, even though through the process of time and what man did, it changed to Judah, but it was going to be Benjamin. God told Shaul, I would establish your line forever. You would obey me. So isn't that ironic? And it's something to think, how does that work? God didn't set this little story about Judah knowing ultimately that King David's line would be the one. So he's showing, if he didn't show that Perez came through this line rather than the Canaanite line, because Judah's sons married Canaanite women. Yeah. That's part of the reason why they had issues. And then, let me retract that. The one married Tamar. And so they refused to have children through Tamar. The rabbis say some things here and there, but the second one, you can read it, it's quite explicit, for the fact that he was not going to have a child with her. So what God's doing is, even though the narrative is going to change and it's going to look a certain way through when we read after Torah, God's setting in here, in his word, saying, no. This is the line, and this shows you the purity of that line. Because if that line was impure, that would negate him being able to be the Messiah line. He could not have been married to someone who couldn't. So it came from Judah, and so that's why this story is told. It's not just an embarrassment to Judah because he did wrong and Joseph did right. It's God's providence showing down the line that we're going to ask questions. Okay, if anybody wants to question the validity of the line of Judah, we can go back to Genesis 38 and say, no, see, this is what God did. He preserved the line. So sometimes what we're reading is something that is beyond what our understanding is. So if we're familiar with Torah, if we're familiar with the Word, if we're familiar with Tanakh, the Old Testament, then we can go back and look and say, no one can say that Judah's line is not pure. It was pure. So David had every right to be the king. Because in Genesis 38, God set it up, and not only that he kept the line pure. So he did that. He's done that several times, as we noticed. Talking about Abimelech, knowing that Sarah was still barren when she was in Abimelech's house, again showing that the line was pure. She did not get pregnant through Abimelech, no matter what people could read into it. So that's a very important part of this. The Messiah's line has to stay pure all the way through. So it's a subplot, but it's a very important subplot if we look at it in context. So I just wanted to bring that up. That's not the gist of what I was going to talk about. But going through the parasha, it's important that we know some of the subplots and the importance that they play in the overall picture, especially to do with the Messiah and coming to that place in, you know, Matthew 1. So I just wanted to go through that part just as informational. The crux of what I wanted to talk about is found in the part that Robin read. The story is Joseph's in prison, so we know he was falsely accused. And even though he's a righteous man, he did what was right before God's eyes. Judah did what was wrong. It's seeming Joseph is being persecuted unfairly. So now he's still in prison. He's done nothing wrong. I guess the part you look at that we really want to look at is, and you know, I've heard messages on Joseph for a long time, a lot of years, and most everybody will not deny that the fact what we come out from seeing Joseph's life is a man of extreme integrity. He did not compromise in any way, shape, or form. And so you can see that all the way through his life. But something that I wanted to highlight today was, and this is how cool the Ruach the Spirit is, you know. I'm knowing Mom and Joanne are going to speak because I asked Mom earlier in the week, you know, I want to spend some time doing this. And, you know, in my back of my mind, I'm going, all right, how am I going to make this work in light of our parasha? Because, you know, I wanted it to meld. I wanted it to gel and say, yeah, it's seamless. We go from this to them telling their story and what happened. And so I'm reading, I'm going through, and I'm just last night, and then all of a sudden, boom, Here it is. Joseph, his hospitality. The man's in prison unfairly. And what does he do? He's in one of the cells sulking and drowning his sorrows in however he can. No. He goes walking, he walks by a cell and he sees two guys whose faces are obviously forlorn. And what does he do? He stops to say, hey, what's going on, guys? I mean, who would do that? How many of us would do that in those circumstances? We've been sold into slavery by our brothers. We've been falsely accused by our master and thrown in prison. And now we're there, and so we have all these things against us and these circumstances and life's pressures. And most of us sit there and go, you know what? I'm just not going to play anymore, God. You're not fair. It's not right. And you're just kind of a mean guy. And so, you know what? I'm going to sit here and just serve my time. I guess what you said, I guess the vision showed me, the dreams aren't true. And how many of us do that? You know, what you promised God is not necessary too. So, you know, poor me, and see if I can enlist some people in my pity party. I mean, that's me. I've done that many, many times. And that's the easy thing to do. But what Joseph showed in asking these men, it wasn't simply how many times we've gone to church and say, hey, how you doing? With no intention of stopping, no intention of listening to their sad story. I mean, a lot of people do that. That's not how he did it. It was sincere. It was something that was real. I read something about the rabbis. They have a saying that to give a friend, a neighbor, or a stranger a cup of cold glass of milk is to fulfill Torah. But they say, beyond that, rather than giving a cold cup of milk to them, if you give them, show them the whites of your teeth instead. So what does that mean? Sometimes a smile and all that entails.
Right.
A compliment, something that encourages them, a word of encouragement. The rabbis say that's greater than just giving them something to drink or eat. So I thought that was kind of a cool thing. And, you know, obviously we have grandma, mom to show that that's what she does in any circumstance. We've been out in the marketplace and, I mean, yesterday some lady walked by and she had some flaming red hair. Mom says, oh, I love your hair. The lady goes, oh, thank you so much. And I'm going, gay. It was bright.
It was true. She always compliments everybody, the waitress or whoever.
But no, that's the way we should be.
You know, pats them. And
right.
It's a big thing, yeah.
But that's fulfilling Torah. That's part of it. And, you know, I can go a lot of different ways with that, but what I wanted to show was it was a genuine response to someone's difficult position. In all of his extremities, he still was able to show God's love and kindness to other people. And these guys were in prison. He didn't know. You know, they could have been the most heinous people you could find, but that didn't matter to him. So that's another important part to play. We don't smile just at the ones who are lovely.
Well, that's easy.
Yeah. So the ones that are that maybe not so lovely, and it has, you know, we want it to be genuine so they don't think we're just placating who they are and their circumstance, but show genuine care for them. So I think, again, we see that from Joseph. He sticks his neck out, you know, he interprets a dream. And it took a lot of courage to do the second one because, you know, looking at the narrative, we think that these are just two regular guys, but for them to serve in Pharaoh's court was not a small thing. And so these were men of prominence and power. And so it's easy to give the one that's, hey, you're going to be released in 3 days. But think about the other one. Sorry, dude, 3 days, you're done. You're going to be hung and the birds are going to be picking on you. So I'm not sure that I would want to deliver that one. That would be a very, very difficult one to deliver. But he did it without hesitation. And so he was a man of truth and integrity, and it carried through even the most difficult of circumstances. So I guess, you know, again, we see Joseph's integrity surpassed his brothers by far, and that, you know, he was deserving of being in the Messiah's line. But, you know, God had other plans. But he was also the only one given two tribes. His tribe was split in two, and he became Manasseh and Ephraim. So there's something else there. So, I mean, those are all kind of really cool things taken out of that part of the parashah. I also read a story. It was a a Holocaust story. I was looking through the rabbinic material, and a story popped up. The guy's name is Martin Greenfeld, and most of us probably not have heard of him. He ended up being a very famous tailor in New York in the late, it had to be the early 50s by that time. And he actually was, they called him the tailor to the presidents. And the story goes that he actually put little notes. And when Eisenhower was president, and Eisenhower would read the notes because he'd order suits from this guy. And so where he came from is his family was taken in the Birkenhold, one of the concentration camps. And he was 15, I think, the story goes. And all his whole family was murdered by the Nazis. He lost every one of his family members. And he was the only one left. And the story he tells is he was about 17 at the time, and they were taken out of camp, him and a few other youths, and they were taken down the road a bit to try and repair the mayor's house. There had bomb gone off in and around it, so it was heavily damaged. So the SS officers were taking these young guys to do hard labor to try and clean up the mess and whatnot. And so, if anyone has seen the pictures of some of these fellows, you know, they're walking skeletons, and he said he was no exception. And so, looking around, trying to assess what they needed to do, he came across a basement, and the door was open. So he peeked in, and he saw two rabbits. And within the rabbit cage, there was some lettuce that was kind of wilty, and then two small pieces of carrot. Well, he was starving, so he went down there and he snagged a little lettuce and ate it, and then he grabbed the piece of the carrot and he started to bite it. Well, then out of nowhere, someone said, "What are you doing?" And it happened to be the mayor's wife, and she's holding a small baby. And he said, "Oh, I found your rabbits. They're okay." She goes, "I know what you're doing. You're stealing my rabbit's food." So she went to the SS officer, told on him. So the officer laid him out and beat him with a baton over his back. And he said what that did to him is that she cared more for the rabbit than for a human being. And so that moment, something entered into him. It was a rage that he couldn't explain. He hated that woman intensely. He wanted to kill her. And so in his mind, he set out to kill that woman no matter what it took him to do. So he goes back, and shortly after that, they're released. You know, the Americans come and they liberate the concentration camp. So him and three other teenagers, they get together, and there's guns everywhere because they disarmed soldiers. So they each grab a gun and they make way to that house. They find the house and they go in and they find the woman with the baby. And he says, "I'm going to kill you. I've come back to do this because you had me beaten for a small piece of carrot." And so he's looking at her and looking at the baby, and then all of a sudden he says, "My teaching kicked in. He was a Torah observant Jew. He was taught Torah from his youth." And so what broke him, and what he says has caused him to become a human being again, is the fact that Torah said, "No, that's not what we do. We forgive those who come against us." And even though that woman had him beat, he had compassion on her with her child there, because obviously he's seen his parents and his siblings torn out of their arms and murdered by the Nazis. So when he turned and walked away from her, he said humanity entered his heart again. All the rage and all the things that would have happened through that circumstance melted away. So it changed his life, and he ended up going to the States and becoming very successful. But that was just a small excerpt from his book talking about what he's overcome in his life. But to me, what was striking is obviously is the thing that his Torah teaching kicked in, and him having compassion on that woman who had him beaten because she had that baby in her arms. And then he read later on that that woman and the mayor ended up committing suicide shortly after because of the atrocities they stood by and watched and helped facilitate. So in his mind, the whole Orthodox idea that karma took over and they got what they deserved. You know, but from our perspective, we know that we're to follow that way regardless of what they get or what they deserve.
Right.
The point is we do what's right. But it was kind of a cool story that what he went through, he still had the capacity through his learning and understanding Torah to have show compassion and forgiveness to someone who wronged him strongly. And so, you know, I was looking through some things, and for me, what comes out of this is Matthew 25, and you know, I always try and integrate something to do with end times here. Matthew 25, 32 through 44, that's the story of the sheep and the goats, and it's a picture of end times. It's basically what we're looking at is the Bema Seat judgment, where all humanity will stand before Yeshua and they'll give account. The ones who did right, and obviously if we read the narrative, it talks about giving a glass of water when we saw them in prison, that we visited them, that we clothed them, that we encouraged them, all the things that we would do as believers in Yeshua and following our master's example, they did. And in their minds, they didn't do anything but what was normal because they replied to Yeshua. When did we see you this, that, and the other thing needing of food and clothing? And he says, as you did this, at least of these, my brothers, you've done it to me. And that points to the Jews, and it points in our days to the extremity that they're going to be going through. That we have to identify them. We have to not let them down again as the Holocaust overtook them by a sleeping church, a church that was not praying, interceding, and moving on their behalf. So, you know, on the other side of the story, the goats, that they paid no attention. They had no understanding, and it wasn't even on their radar to look for people who were suffering and going through what they were going through. And so it's going to be a distinct picture of two types of people. Those who intercede and move on behalf of Israel and those who don't. And we can already see the difference. The first says, come into the glory which is the kingdom set for you beforehand. The other is, go into utter darkness where there is difficulty, and basically he's talking about hell. So it's a huge contrast in what's going to happen to those who do what he does as Yeshua did. He saw the broken heart and downtrodden, I think it was Isaiah 61, and that's why he came, to do those things, to help and to be with them. And just to make no mistake that this is the mandate, I always go back to 1 John. Everybody's probably familiar with it, but to me it's like, if there's any mistake that we're making in not understanding why we do what we do and how Torah is so important, I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from 1 John. We'll start in chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. And by this we know that we have known him if we keep his commandments. The one saying, I have known him, and not keeping his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word truly is the one. In this one, the love of Adonai has been perfected. By this we know that we are in him. 15 and 16. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him, because all that which is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but of the world. Then chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. What matter of love the Father has given us, that we may be called sons of Adonai, who has made us. For this reason the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are the sons of Adonai, and it was not yet revealed what we shall be, but we know that if he is revealed, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. Then in verse 10, by this the children of Adonai are distinguished from the children of the devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness and does not have his brother, does not love his brother, does not belong to Adonai. I think 3:17. But whoever has worldly possessions and sees his brother in need and shuts up his mercy from him, how is the love of Adonai in him? And I could go on. There's a couple more verses in there. But basically what John's talking about is that to have love for our brother requires the love to us to love Adonai, Hashem. And the only way to do that is coming to a and John would have already said this previously, but coming to not just a saving knowledge, but to follow Yeshua as Master, as he did. And in his commandments, he talks in Matthew 5, 6 and 7, gives us a clear picture. But John shows a little deeper picture that loving Yeshua requires us keeping his commandments. So in other words, we just can't have faith, we have to have action. And the fact that we have a whole paradigm, a way of looking at things found in Torah. That's how we can find exactly what we need to do before God. And that's the importance of Torah. So John connects the love of Yeshua with following the commandments and obedience. And by that way, God's love is shed in our hearts, and we're able to not only love ourselves properly, but we're also love others in that same way. And that's something that's missing. Joseph obviously had a great understanding of who he was, his identity in God, because he never looked to a place where he wanted to put himself above anyone else. He was always obedient. He's always took the place of humility. He always took the place of service. So when we have the right identity of who we are in God, no matter what someone else thinks about us, that to have that identity in Yeshua is the greatest thing. Because without that, we're going to treat others wrongly, because we're going to put ourselves in a place of prominence over them, because we're still working from a very poor identity crisis in Yeshua. And I guess for me, it works down all the way to a place of leadership. I've watched leaders throughout the years of me being in various churches. You can always tell where people are deficient in their identity with Yeshua, because they have to self-propagate. Everything is about them, and very little is about putting and pointing his flock to follow Yeshua, the Master. Not Pastor the Master. It's Yeshua the Master. Because he is the resource, and the pastor is not. He's simply giving instruction and guidance and prayer support, but it's never to take the place of Yeshua. Never to take that place of intimacy there. So for me, that's what I see, that when you have a proper identity in Yeshua, you're not going to put yourself in front of people. And we're not going to step over people, and we're not going to step on people. And that goes from whoever the least of the saints are to who we believe the greatest of the saints are. That should be the identity we have. And so in that process, we're able to do for others. That's how Joseph was able to ask them how they were, rather than whining about what his circumstances were. Does that make sense? So for me, that's the vivid reality. I think Joseph had a great understanding. And it was a picture. His dad loved him greatly. And maybe to Joseph, or to Jacob's detriment, he didn't maybe love the other brothers as much. And so they responded in a very, very poor way. And so, you know, it's a clear picture of that, having a good understanding of the Father's love for us and what Yeshua did in context, that we never need to step on people. That we can always say, hey, how are you doing? And be genuine about it. Is there anything I can do for you? I mean, that's the life of obedience. That's the life of following the Master Yeshua. That's what he did for 3.5 years. Walked around serving mankind, and in the process teaching them about the kingdom that's coming and what it looks like and how they should respond to it. So, I mean, those are the important parts, and that's the essence of what I see working in Joseph. Not just a man of integrity, but a man of compassion and mercy and great love. So I'm cutting it off there. I wanted Mom and Sandy to be able to share. So I'm just going to bring this over so we can keep it on the table.
Keep what on the table?
On the table.
I'm just checking you.